see that the sounds of the season are with us. The coughing, the wheezing, the other things of that sort. I had told you last time, we're in Genesis chapter 3, if you'll join me there. I told you last time I had a few notes that I wanted us to spend a little bit of time on, but it turned out that during the hour last time, we got through most of these. Note, for example, that when God has come to confront them after their sin, both the man and the woman admitted their guilt, but they were pleading extenuating circumstances, which if you trace it properly was really blaming God. But in each case, they did say, I ate it. They did speak their guilt. You need to hold that thought in mind, because as we get deeper into Genesis, it's going to be important to remember that. I have one, thank you. You also notice the serpent either gives no response or is not given any opportunity for a response. We noted last time God's questions. Where are you? He asked the man. Who told you you were naked? He asks. Have you been eating of the tree I told you not to eat from? And finally, to the woman, why did you do that? Pretty powerful questions. I want you to note in chapter 3, verse 6, there's a very interesting word that's used. If you look in chapter 2, verse 24, there's an interesting word that's used. In chapter 2, verse 24, the woman is referred to as, quote, his wife. And in chapter 3, verse 6, the man is referred to as her husband. That language is used very, very early. And there are some who think that the institution of marriage was instituted later. That doesn't seem to be the case. We talked a bit about why the serpent approached the woman first. We talked about how if the woman was a helper to the man, if the man had been approached first and had given fruit to the woman, there would have been less guilt in her case. So coming to the woman first, that was a part of it. That's not all of it. Chris, I think I saw your hand.
It's not clear to me why the serpent spoke to the woman first. Did you think that she was superior to the man?
Oh dear.
Let me repeat what I just said. When we talked about this last week, the woman was created to be a helper to the man. This is not an explanation, it's simply an observation. If the man had been the one the serpent had approached, and the man had then given fruit to his wife, she would have incurred less guilt. By approaching the woman first, her guilt is on a level with the man. And I don't think that adequately covers the ground, but it's all you're going to get from me.
That's the best explanation I've ever heard of.
Yeah. Bless you, my child. Now, I do want to spend just a little bit of time before we leave this on the fig leaves. Verse 7, they have eaten the fruit. This is chapter 3, verse 7, they have eaten the fruit. My translation says, the eyes of both of them were opened and they realized they were naked. And I like the way it's worded. So they sewed. I think I pointed this out to you last week. So they sewed. They sewed fig leaves together to make themselves loincloths. I pointed out to you last week, I do know something about fig leaves because I picked figs for fig preserves off of a big bush in my mother-in-law's yard. Fig leaves do have some size to them. They do have some size to them. But boy, are they itchy if you touch them. And showers don't seem to take that away very quickly. I found myself wondering what the experience would have been like for them. It is important to note what comes later. It's within this chapter, but it's very important to note what comes later. There is a theological moment that you can hang here, I think it fits. I don't think it's a distortion of what's here to say this. The man and the woman tried to provide their own covering for sin, and it was inadequate. When God provides a covering, look at what He provides, look at what is implied by what He provides, and think about the other implications. There is a book that I got a hold of a week or two ago. It's an interesting book to read because it's a book that criticizes much of Christianity. And one of the things that is said in there is that there is no way that salvation could come to people in the Old Testament because they knew nothing of Jesus. The Old Testament is suffused with the message of Jesus. It's here all the way through, and it's included in even that part of things. This chapter 3 has messianic references to Jesus in several places through it, and the idea of the covering is one of those. Now, having said that, I want to take you for just a moment to Matthew chapter 22. And in Matthew chapter 22 is one of the stranger parables that Jesus ever told. If you've been in this group for a while, you may remember us talking about this before. But let's see how we do. Matthew 22, verse 1, Jesus began to speak to them in parables once again. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a feast for his son's wedding. He sent his servants to call those who had been invited, but they would not come. Next, he sent more servants with these words, "Tell those who have been invited, look, my banquet is all prepared. My oxen and fattened cattle have been slaughtered. Everything is ready. Come to the wedding." But they were not interested. One went off to his farm, another to his business, and the rest seized his servants, maltreated them, and killed them. The king was furious. He dispatched his troops, destroyed those murderers, and burnt their towns. And then he said to his servants, "The wedding is ready, but as those who were invited proved to be unworthy, go to the main crossroads and invite everyone you can find to come to the wedding." One of the other gospels in a parallel section uses the word compel. Compel everyone you find to come. So those servants went out onto the roads and collected together everyone they could find, bad and good alike, and the wedding hall was filled with guests. Now, stop for a moment, and let's just make sure we know. This is a parable. It is a story with a deeper truth than the story itself. Who is the king? God. Who is the son? Jesus. Who is the son marrying in this wedding? The church. Okay? And what has happened is people who have been invited have refused to come. He has sent his servants. Who are his servants? The prophets. Prophets and witnesses. And what has happened? They have been maltreated by those who have refused to come. He's telling this parable in the presence of the leaders who are refusing to recognize Jesus as Messiah. So it's a very interesting sort of tension-filled moment. And so far, everything is fairly straightforward, and if he stops here, everything is fine. But he doesn't stop here. He goes just a little bit further. When the king came in to look at the guests, who were the guests? Whoever happened to be out on the highways and byways, good and bad alike, they have come in. When the king went in to look at the guests, he noticed one man who was not wearing a wedding garment. And he said to him, "How did you get in here, my friend, without a wedding garment?" The man was silent. The king said to the attendants, what did he say, roughly? Kick him out. For many are invited, but not all are chosen. I will not pretend that I understand all of what's there, but I will tell you the idea of covering is significantly and importantly placed. Jesus said that his father sent, the king sent out and said, just bring them in, good and bad alike. But they're all to wear a covering. And the one who refuses to wear the covering Now, there's lots of stuff to hang on that, and I don't want to hang it all on there this morning. That would simply take all of our time in that direction. But I want to tell you, this idea of the covering is important. What we're going to be looking at in chapter 3 is the man and the woman provided their own covering, and it was inadequate. God provides a covering, and it's different. Okay? Now, let's move ahead. I'm back in Genesis. Are you back in Genesis? Excellent. In a moment, I'll be back in Genesis 3. Up till now, God has had a hearing. He has asked questions. He has gotten responses. You come to verse 14. You now have the time when you think what you're going to hear is the verdict. You think that's what's going to happen. You've had a hearing. The witnesses have been heard. They have declared their guilt. The man and the woman have. The serpent has been silent. They have pled extenuating circumstances, including blaming God for all the trouble that they are in. And now come the time for the verdict. God says to the snake, because you have done this, what's the next phrase? What's the verb in there?
Cursed.
You are cursed. Okay? Would you please look down at verse 16 when he begins to talk to the woman? Is she cursed? No. Come to verse 17 when he speaks to the man. Is the man cursed? No, but something is. The ground is cursed. The verdict isn't applied to the man and the woman. Consequences are applied. The verdict is applied to the serpent, but not to the man and the woman. Now we're going to explore that for just a moment. Let's start with the serpent. What's the verdict? You're cursed. And if you listen to the verdict seems to come in two parts. One part seems to apply to snake, and one part seems to apply to that old serpent. What is he saying to the snake? Read it.
You'll crawl on your belly?
You're going to crawl on your belly like a reptile. Well, yeah. Okay. Notice how dust figures in this. You're going to eat dust, it says. Well, that's what happens when you're slithering around on the ground. You almost hear a two-part verdict here, and there's a possibility. Please don't hear me as giving you a conclusion. Hear me suggesting a one way of reading this. Satan maybe has used a snake, and a verdict is given to the snake for having been used, and a serpent is given to Satan for having used. What happens to the snake? You're on your belly. What's the snake been doing before? We don't know. That insight is not given to us. Okay. What's the verdict to Satan? Verdict to Satan seems to come in verse 15. Okay? Although there's an argument about the middle of the last of verse 14. When he talks about eating dust, okay, when he talks about eating dust, there's at least one commentator who argues for two ways to see that. One is a picture, snakes are going to end up slithering on the ground, kicking up dust, and they're going to have to breathe that. That's maybe the phrase that's there. But there's a second phrase. Now, for this particular phrase, you have to have been a bad boy with a good car when you were young. I don't think many of you ladies qualify for this, but a few of the men will. Tell me what the phrase, eat my dust, means. How many of you know? Okay. What's the picture? My car is hotter than you. I'm going to outrun you. You're going to eat my... What does it mean, then, to eat my dust? What does that mean? I'm going to defeat you. If I'm eating dust, what does that mean? I've been defeated. Okay. There's a commentator. Remember, I've told you I'm sort of pulling some things out of that. If you go to that commentator, you'll read. You'll hear him walking a line. He says, well, you can't be sure of this. But one way to read this is the eating of dust could imply everything you try, you're going to end up frustrated. That he's saying this to Satan, to the snake that Satan used, if that's the way this is interpreted. You're going to be on your belly the rest of your life. And men are going to be so afraid of you, they're going to get... Hey, people keep as pets horses, right? People keep as pets raccoons. Right? Right? Sometimes. Okay. I don't remember very many people keeping snakes as pets, but they do. Some of them do. I don't sense the snakes responding with the kind of love that little puppies give. I don't sense that. You know, you keep a scorpion as a pet. You keep a snake. It just doesn't. I know people do it. I'm not saying there's not idiocy loose in the world, but I know people do this. But you know, this is not the sort of warm fuzzies you get with pets, right? There's going to be enmity between the two. It is a famous moment in my wife's family when they discovered that Barbara knew how to fly. True story. Ask her sometime. Look at her face. Okay. They were out in the woods. They were walking down a path. She was getting ready to take a step when her sister noticed that her foot was going to come down on top of a coiled rattlesnake. And her family says, we do not know what happened. All we know is her foot never came down. She flew somehow and landed on the other side. You can interpret that however you wish. Her family interprets it as she learned how to fly for a moment. Okay? Snakes are not good things. Enmity between the two. On dust you will feed. For the snake, for the serpent, frustration. You will think you have triumphed. And every time you will be wrong. Every time you will be wrong. At least on the big things. Verse 15, I will put enmity between you and the woman. Again, the commentator suggests hearing two parts, between human beings and physical snakes, and between human beings and the old serpent. Now, the tail end of verse 15, you have to go to about four or five different translations, and you almost have to dig into the original Hebrew to get everything that's here. And I don't suggest I know how to do that, so I don't suggest I'm bringing you everything. In my translation, it says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, he is speaking to the serpent here, and between your offspring and hers, it will bruise your head, and you will strike its heel. There are translations that use the word he. Do you have some? Are those translations in the room? She just talked about offspring, right? That's plural. But what comes back here is a singular. And some people see that as a messianic prophecy. There will be among your children one who will crush the head of the old serpent. Now, let me stop for a minute. Do you have either questions or comments? Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. All right, I'd like to hear your comment on it. At what point does Satan come into the picture? And did God create Satan? Was it at this time?
Okay, when we talked about the serpent at the very first of chapter 3, I took you into Ezekiel and I took you into Isaiah. There is a history here. And the history is dim and vague, but it isn't completely empty. There appears to be a creation of beings that you and I would call angels, and among those angels the leading one was Satan, and something happened and he has been removed from his place because of arrogance, because of his attempts to replace God. That has happened. When did that happen? We don't know. John suggested an idea that goes between chapter 1, verse 1 and chapter 1, verse 2. I don't particularly find that appealing to me, but I understand that there are people who find that argument appealing. Whenever that happened, Satan has been around. And you get glimpses of how he thinks and how he functions at the first of Job. And we looked through all of that. Satan's appearance in the garden seems to have come as a surprise to the man and the woman. We're not given any clue that they knew who this person was in that larger sense when he came into the garden. I don't know that, but the scripture doesn't seem to hint anything. So I think that's probably the best response I can give you. Anybody else?
I always thought that the snake was Satan. That's what I think we've been told all our lives.
The personage who came into the garden, I believe, is representing is Satan. What form he took, that I don't know. There's a commentator that suggests maybe he took the form of or used a snake of some kind so that there was a duality to that appearance. In which case, in here, God's curse is extending both to the physical snake that Satan was using as his avatar or representative and to Satan himself. Perhaps there was only one, and this applies just to that one. But to say the snake was not Satan, absolutely no. The snake was Satan, but whether there was some duality to that appearance, that's the piece I don't know. And I don't want to try to read further into the Bible than the Bible itself speaks. It almost sounds as if there's two messages in this curse, not one. And I want to be true to that. Okay? Let's move to verse 16. To the woman he says, what does he not say? You're cursed. And at that moment, I think Satan's head spun. I invited you last time to ponder this question. What was Satan expecting to happen? Satan was expecting, yeah, I'm going to get cursed. That's fine. That's fine, just more of the same. I've already experienced some of that. But what was he expecting to happen? He was expecting to end this process of God's investing in human beings. And that verdict does not fall. In comparison to what could have and perhaps should have fallen for the level of their disobedience, it's amazing in its absence. Now, how many things does he say? The first thing he says, and then he almost repeats it. What's the first thing he says to the woman? I will increase your pain in childbirth. Increase from what? She hasn't had a child yet. What's the baseline for this? That sounds a little odd. Keep going. What's the second phrase? With pain you will give birth to your children. Okay. Does yours say increase? Okay. All right. Now, what's the next one? Your desire will be for your husband. My translation says your yearning will be for your husband. I need the word desire. And several translations will have that word. What in the world does that mean? What's the next phrase? He will rule over you. Okay. I'm not sure there's a more confusing verse in this part of the Bible.
I was going to say, tenderness might, argue with the second question.
I don't know that they would argue that that's what happens. They might argue it shouldn't happen. But I don't know that they would argue that it does happen. Okay? Now, first of all, the full verdict was withheld. Consequences fell. But the full verdict appears to be held in abeyance. We're going to talk about that later. The word, you are cursed, is not there. It's not there. increased pain in childbirth. Does anybody have any word other than birth?
Childbearing.
Okay. I am told by people who are able to do it that when you dig into the Hebrew, there is a shade of meaning that's here that most translations are not bringing up. And that meaning is or could be rendered as the experience of bearing and raising children will have pain associated with it all the way through at levels that you will not believe. And if that doesn't ring true for everybody in this room, you haven't been living on planet Earth very long. Is your reaction the same as mine? Is your reaction the same as mine? What could have been gentle, pleasant, and perfect will no longer and will not ever be. Even the first experience will be painful beyond painful. And it doesn't stop when childbirth is over. It has childbearing and child rearing.
Martin was right on track.
He wanted the humans to experience the pain that he felt because of what they did.
I don't know that I want to go far enough to read that into it, but I certainly want to recognize that that's there. Look at the pain I'm experiencing. You're going to experience it too. And all of a sudden you see a depth to this verse that is horrible because it is real.
It still applies after the groan.
Doesn't it though? Got your attention? Good. Let's go to the next word. What's the next word? I'll take those two phrases and consider that we've at least addressed those. The next one is your desire for your husband. Huh. What an odd thing to say. Your desire will be for your husband. Isn't that a good thing? Let me invite you to notice something. The next time the word desire is used in your translation, you think you could find it real quickly, just sort of scan through? Let me make a little help for you, right? Check over in chapter 4, verse 6 and verse 7. Do you find the word desire in there? If you found the word desire in this first place, there's a good chance you're going to find the word desire in there. Not all of you will, but many of you will. Do you find the word desire?
Verse 7.
Okay. Can somebody read, because my translation doesn't include that word, and I think the word needs to be included if only to match it up with what's back here. Okay. In my translation it says yearning, and in this translation it says hungry to get you. What does yours say in that verse? Chapter 4, verse 6 and 7. Somebody read that. Okay, go ahead.
Then verse 6, the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, you will not be accepted. But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it."
In what context is the word desire being used here? Chapter 4, verse 6 and 7.
Satan's making wait for you.
Satan is looking to control you, to take you over, to direct you into directions that they want to do. If that word also applies back in verse 16 of chapter 3, if that same shade of meaning applies, then what do you end up with? Disharmony. Because now you got two vying for control of the other. Okay. Whether you like it or not, what was God's plan? She would be a helper to him. And boy, does he need help. Do not miss that last phrase. If you don't tack that phrase on, then it doesn't carry the weight it needs to carry. She was built as a helper for him. Why? He was not going to survive without that help. It is not good that man should be alone. He depends on that help. Without that help, he is lost and lost indeed. Her very creation was designed to be his helper. And there was a harmony built. She was to bring out the best in him, and he was to bring out the best in her. And all of a sudden in verse 16, it's almost a prediction, but I think you need to see it as a consequence. You let sin in the door, and this is what sin is going to create. It's going to create discord in the family. And what's his response going to be? He's going to dominate you. My translation says dominate, yours says rule over. Because that's the response you get when this discord comes. Who just got blamed in this process? Everybody in sight. What's the consequence of sin? When you start raising children, it's going to be a train wreck. You are going to have pain like you wouldn't believe, and it's going to start at birth and it's never going to stop. And in your own family, you're going to end up vying with your husband instead of cooperating with your husband. And there's going to be consequences that come, and it's going to be awful for everybody involved. That's what sin does when it comes inside of a family. Does this verse begin to take on dimensions that you can begin to see what it's talking about now? No, ho, ho. Whoever whispered that, no, ho, ho.
It was louder than a whisper.
For any one of us to say to any other one of us, it's all your fault, you didn't read that verse properly. Where's the blame to be fixed? I have to say it again because it seems like somebody didn't hear. Everybody in sight. Because the affixing of blame is part of the discord. That's part of the discord. To the man, he said, because you listened to the voice of your wife and ate from the tree of which I had forbidden you to eat, and it doesn't say, cursed are you. What does it say? The created order experiences the consequence of the sin of human beings. The created order experiences the consequences of their sin. Now, there's a play on words here, and you have to see the play on words. Let me go deeper into my notes until I can find where I put these notes. I put them somewhere. Where are they? Oh, draft. There they are. Okay. Now, these are transliterated from Hebrew into English. The Hebrew word Adam or Adam means what? It means man. That word, Adama, means what? It means ground. My brother has a close friend, a very close friend, whose nickname is Dusty. Good nickname. Very good nickname. You came from the ground, you're going back to the ground. The ground is cursed because of what you've done. You have been working. You have been working. There was hard work to do. Said at the first of this part, before the creation of this man, the earth had not been tilled. This man was tilling the earth. He was a farmer. He was a gardener. God says, your work is going to increase. You are going to sweat. And nature is going to conspire against you. Nature is no longer going to be cooperative. The food you need is going to grow. There's many places in the Old Testament that talk about this. God will provide the food, but the thorns and the thistles come up too. Are you reading this? Do you see this? If you wanted to put two words on it, what would you put? Thorns and sweat. the ground is cursed because of you, and what you experience is going to be thorns and sweat. What did Jesus experience on the last day of his life?
Thorns
and sweat. He was sweating blood. Don't miss that parallel. I don't think that's a parallel that is improper to draw. Let me see if I can get back on track. Nature turns hostile. He's going to have to sweat to get that. Did you notice dust for both the serpent and for the man and the woman? Dust you are, to dust you will return, he says to the man and the woman. Okay. What did Satan expect? The immediate destruction of this man and this woman and the end of God's love for these creatures. What came? Consequences, harsh consequences, but not the verdict. And I think Satan was surprised. What is the first thing Adam does after God quits speaking? Way back in chapter 2, God was bringing all the wild animals, all the cattle, all these to the man. And what was the man doing? He was naming them. And we talked about what all that meant. Right? Who named the woman? God did. And then Adam did. Let me try to show you what I mean by that. Turn to chapter 5, verse 1. Turn to chapter 5. Verse 1. This is the role of Adam's descendants. Verse 2. On the day that God created Adam, he made him in the likeness of God. Male and female, he created them. He blessed them and gave them the name man or human being when they were created. The commentator that I'm reading said this will cause problems because it is not politically correct, but when someone says chairman or someone says postman, the word man was her name, just as it was his name. We hold these truths in it, that all men are created equal. What was her name? Her name was man, just like his was. But he gives her a new name. What's his name? What's the name? And what does it mean? The Hebrew is H-A, two W's, A-H, at least when rendered in English. Change the two W's to a Y, and you get to live. He named her Eve because she was what? The mother of all who live. Satan said, "You will not die." God says, "You will die." Adam has seen a middle ground. We will die, but before we die, life will go on. And the record of this sentence, of this verse, is Adam's faith and trust in what God has said. And it's a little hard to spot. Her offspring, he said to Satan. Adam says, she's going to have children, because she sure hasn't had children until now. And among those offspring will be one that crushes Satan. Adam trusted that. And he names her mother of all who live before she's had a single child. There is a faith statement that comes from Adam that needs to be noted as we walk by. I've shown you before those interesting stories about mitochondrial clocks and all that kind of stuff. Secular scientists are saying somewhere back there is a woman who's the mother of every person who is alive on planet Earth today. You listen to his phrase. He named her Eve because she was the mother of all who live. We don't have time to go any further than that. Skins are next. Yes, sir.
You kind of breezed through verse 19, but is it a stretch to say that the verdict for Adam was that your time on this earth is going to be tough, and he learned of his mortality?
Yeah. That is a fair way of putting it. Adam's faith is, I will not live on earth forever, but I am a living being. And there is all kinds of stuff in the New Testament to hang on that. And we'll try to develop some of that as time goes by. Let's have a word of prayer before we go. Our Father, there are deep truths here, and we pray that your Spirit would be alive in each one of us to open our minds and our hearts to these truths. I pray that you would let us be accurate to what you're trying to say. But I pray also that you would allow us to be inspired by what you say, to understand better who we are in your sight, so that we can be disciples of yours and witnesses of yours in this world in which you've put us. We pray all this in your Son's name. Amen.